gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you. And welcome to the London Palladium, what is a pretty, going to be a pretty unusual evening. Now, this stage in front of us has played host to some of the greatest names in British entertainment. We've had Bruce Forsyth from the London Palladium, Marvin Gaye, Tommy Steele, Jimmy Tarbuck, Rob Little, and the MP for North East Somerset in this line of apostolic succession. That is in itself unusual, but what is really unusual is that almost 2,500 of you have come here this evening for an evening of political discussion. Now, it doesn't happen very often. We tried to find out the last time it did happen, when an MP drew in crowds of this. It was Lloyd George in 1912. So, perhaps a bit modern for our guest this evening. But anyway, but the thing is, that is what makes tonight different. It's not that an MP is answering questions, that happens all the time. Not that a journalist is asking questions, you can see that all the time on TV. What makes it extraordinary is that so many of you are here. So what I'm going to do is invite as many of you as I can to ask questions and to join in the discussion. Now, some of you have been kind enough to email questions already. Some of you have handed them in right now. If any of you feel inspired halfway through, you can email me if you have one of these mobile devices that you're supposed to not have switched on. Fraser@spectator.co.uk, give me your name and your seat number. And if you have submitted a question, listen out for your name, because I can come to you at any point to make sure you're paying attention. So, if there are any of our friends from the protesting community here tonight, so with a balaclava in your pocket, please wait until after the interval to storm the stage, because once we've had a drink, we'll find it all the more amusing. Without any further ado, let me say words I never thought I would say. That tonight, live from the stage of a London Palladium, please welcome Jacob Rees-Mogg. Where to start? What about what's going to happen in 31 days' time? Britain is going to leave the EU, or maybe not. We don't have a deal. We don't have anything resembling a deal. The strategy seems to be pretty much of a shambles. It's being negotiated by a prime minister whose personal authority is pretty low, weakened because of a botched attempt to get rid of her, led by you. And I would politely put it to you that this situation, the Brexit situation, is a mess made more so by your personal endeavours.
Well, I, not surprisingly, don't agree. But as you, I think, pointed out, I'm a backbench MP. My influence is very limited. Much more important is the fact that any number of cabinet ministers seem to have threatened to resign earlier on. And in spite of the fact that the Conservative Party manifesto said that no deal was better than a bad deal, that we would leave the single market and the customs union and out of the jurisdiction of the ECJ, a number of ministers seem to have forgotten the platform on which they were elected, seem to want to abandon it, and I don't. I have consistently, and people within the European Research Group have consistently stuck to the manifesto on what we were elected and on the vote made by 17.4 million people. The point at which I wrote a letter of no confidence in the Prime Minister was when we knew that her withdrawal agreement was actually Brexit in name only and was not delivering on what had been promised. And I know you hinted at my being old-fashioned in your generous introduction, but I'm old-fashioned enough to think that politicians should stick to their promises, and I was worried that that wasn't happening.
Mm.
But you would have known that if you were going to make a leadership coup, if you had failed and if you had missed, the result would be even less authority and an even worse Brexit. So would it not, in retrospect, have been better not to have tried than to have shot and wounded rather than got to a better situation?
I think perhaps you have a kindly view of the authority that the Prime Minister had earlier in this process.
That it couldn't have got worse, you're saying?
Once, broadly, yes. That once the general election result had come through, the Prime Minister's authority was very seriously dented. And for the ensuing 15 months, the Eurosceptics in the party did everything they could to try and help the Prime Minister deliver on what she had promised. And this became increasingly difficult because it turned out that things were being discussed behind the backs of Brexit secretaries. People didn't know what was going on. They weren't kept properly informed. But this weakening of authority came from Downing Street, not from the backbenches. Once we discovered the facts, the text of the withdrawal agreement, I don't think we really had any choice. That in politics, either you can snipe from the sidelines, you can give anonymous briefings, you can feed poison into people's ears, or you can stand up and say, actually, this isn't good enough, we need a change. And that's what we said and what we tried to do. It didn't work, and therefore we had to accept that result.
And the net result of all this is what? Where are we this evening on Brexit?
I think the question of the Prime Minister's authority is as much to do with her lack of majority in the House of Commons than anything else. If the Prime Minister had a majority of 150, her authority would be quite remarkable. And very few people would even be trying to vote against her because they wouldn't succeed. When there is no majority, then any group, big or small, can throw stones into the pond. And that is what is happening. And that means we're in a very unstable and difficult political period. Added to which, probably 500 out of 650 members of Parliament never wanted Brexit in the first place and are out of tune with the majority of voters who did. And I think I think the disconnect between our elected politicians and the voters is bigger than it has probably ever been. And that is a real problem for British politics because people want to leave and it's being obstructed by members of Parliament who think voters got it wrong. And that's a worrying situation.
Okay, well, let's take a first question from Paul Stevenson. If our system's working, you should have the mic right in front of your nose. Okay, next. is it? No, okay. Let's talk about what the Prime Minister is proposing right now, which is a delay to Brexit. And a question from Luke McGee, if that's working.
Hello?
We can't see you, unfortunately,
no,
because
we
the lights
see
are so bright.
I'm up here, I'm afraid, Jacob. You've spoken very eloquently and about facts and reality. If we're going to talk about the reality of politics today, the government's formally put the idea of delaying Brexit on the table. Why won't you and your friends in the ERG get behind the withdrawal agreement, which formally actually puts all options back on the table, including Canada Plus or no deal?
Well, the problem with the withdrawal agreement is that it ties us into an Irish backstop that has no end date. And that keeps us in the customs union. It keeps regulatory alignment between Northern Ireland and the European Union. And it requires customs declarations, ultimately, to be made between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, splitting up the United Kingdom. Now, that is, to me, intolerable. I am a unionist. I want Northern Ireland to remain part of the United Kingdom, and I think it is as much part of the United Kingdom as Somerset is, unless and until it wants to leave, which it does have the right to do, and Somerset doesn't have the right to leave, I'm glad to say. I would oppose it exercising this right if it had it. And an agreement that divides up our nation, I think, is wrong, and that is why I will vote against it unless the backstop is fundamentally changed, because it doesn't, unfortunately, deliver the options you're suggesting. It ties us into a system where unless we agree to go along with what the EU wants in the final stage, they can just keep us trapped in the backstop, which gives the EU everything it wants and doesn't give us what we want.
Okay. Paul Stevenson, no?
Yes.
Oh. Great, it's working. Hey,
I'm here.
Okay. Yep, ask away.
Jacob, what do you think the chances are of the referendum result being delivered in a form that most leavers thought they were voting for?
It's in the balance right now, isn't it?
It's a very important question. Most people who want delay want to stop Brexit. And it's important to recognise what their motives are. They think most of us are stupid. And I may be, but I know, ladies and gentlemen, you're not. Because you're, well, you're readers of The Spectator, therefore you've got to be highly intelligent. And they are doing everything they can to stop it, and they know they've only got, 31 days left?
And
3 hours in which to stop it. And we're going to use up most of those 3 hours, so by the time we finish, it'll just be 31 days. And so if they succeed in getting their delay, and they then try and have another delay, then yes, absolutely, Brexit is at risk. But as yet, they don't have the courage to say that they want to stop it. Because they recognise that going against the biggest democratic exercise in our nation's history is something really quite profound, quite risky in terms of how our democracy works. And so, although it's what they want, it's the love that dare not speak its name. So they're pretending it's something else. It's delay, it's a second referendum, it's the Norway option plus. And so I think Brexit will be delivered, because I don't think people have the courage, I'm glad to say, to stop it, and because 17.4 million people will demand that it is delivered. And any party that decided not to would be punished at the ballot box. And if we tried to stay, and we stayed beyond the European elections, I think there'd only be one winner from that, and that would be Tommy Robinson. And I think this country has been very fortunate in not having extremists in its political life. Almost throughout our history, we've avoided the very far left and the very far right. And I think that's been good for us as a nation. But I think if you decide that 17.4 million people voting is insignificant and should be overridden by 500 MPs, then you create the atmosphere for extremism.
Okay. But one of the reasons that MPs have had cold feet about Brexit is that all we hear about is what a disaster is going to be. I think you were once quoted saying that the benefits will be apparent in something like 50 years, or rather a long time frame, put it that way. And that's the basis for our next question from Roger Thompson. I might just say
hi, good evening. Hi, I'm a voice in the dark here. Mr. Rees-Mogg, my question is, what do you say to those who are not well off or the squeezed middle classes that economic hardship or potential future economic hardship is a price worth paying for an unknown future quantity when leaving the EU?
Well, first of all, Fraser, you seem to have joined the New Statesman, because what I said was that the benefits would be seen over 50 years, not after 50 years. Some people on the left are unable to distinguish between over and after, but I'm slightly surprised that the editor of The Spectator doesn't have this at his fingertips. But the question is a very important one, because one of the reasons I support Brexit is that I think it helps improve people's standard of living. That is the real benefit. Where do I start? Well, first of all, let's start with tariffs. Because protectionism protects vested interests, it does not protect consumers. And politicians should be on the side of consumers, not least because you're our voters, but also because it's more economically efficient. That if you cut tariffs, they would have the biggest effect on food, clothing, and footwear. That makes up a particularly large proportion of the expenditure of the least well-off in our society. You give them an immediate boost to their standard of living by cutting tariffs. Now, you may want to phase it out in some areas to soften the blow for producers who have been used to being protected. But a lot of our protectionism protects inefficient continental industries that we don't even have. So that's a very important initial step. But it goes further, because if you make your economy more efficient, everybody is better off. And protectionism protects inefficiency. That's its whole purpose. It protects those businesses that are not competitive with the rest of the world, that need to charge higher prices. And the European Union specializes in that, to have a fortress against the rest of the world, to force prices up, to protect incumbents. And this is why organizations like the CBI are so in favor of the European Union, because it protects their members from competition. And when the CBI, this is very, very interesting, surprising, when the CBI lists its members, it says it's got 180,000 associate members. Well, a third of those are either members of the National Farmers Union or the Country Landowners Association. Well, we know from our history that the group of people that's always the most pro-protection are the people who own the land that gets protected from it, back to Lloyd George's debate over 100 years ago. But the other area, economically, that is beneficial for the less well-off in society is the free movement of labour, because the people who are most affected by the free movement of labour are the least well-off in our society, whose wages have hardly risen in real terms in the last 20 years. Why? Because they've been undercut by an easy flow of labour coming from Eastern Europe. But that has two effects. One, it keeps their wages down, but also it delays and deters innovation and automation, which leads to increased productivity. But increased productivity means that there's more money in the economy to pay the higher wages that you are able to pay to the domestic workforce that is currently being outcompeted by cheaper labour coming in. So I'm very confident that economically, Brexit is a huge advantage, and most particularly to those who are not the best off in our society.
But you've given a version of how Brexit could go. That's your free trade, your low tariff version. It is by no means the version the party's going to have. We had Michael Gove a few days ago talking, saying that he would put tariffs up. So surely once Brexit does happen, if Brexit does happen, the Conservative Party then need to decide if they're going to go for the Rees-Mogg low tariff version of events, which might lead to the low prices you do, or whether the CBI members, the Farmers Union members, are going to find friends in the House of Commons who are going to argue for high tariffs, as Michael Gove's department is already doing.
Well, I'd say two things to that. One is that Liam Fox announced in a statement yesterday that, for example, the punitive tariffs put on by the European Union on solar panels from China will go. And that's beneficial because they're on there to protect a German industry. It's an industry we don't have in the UK. And it means that renewable energy will be made cheaper in this country. That's already been announced. That will happen if we leave without a withdrawal agreement. But the other thing I'd say is that this is a question of democracy. I will stand for election, putting in my election address, and I will argue within the Conservative Party that we should be the free trade party. We should be on the side of consumers. We should be on the side of cheaper prices. Michael Gove may be with Lord George Bentinck arguing for the reintroduction of the corn laws. That would be a mistake. And our socialist friends will certainly be arguing for protectionism. But I think our economic system should be decided, ladies and gentlemen, by your votes. And if I can't persuade you of the advantages of free trade, and if I can't persuade you that you will be better off under free trade and your standard of living will rise, then I don't deserve to win elections. But I think it should be up to you rather than the exclusive competence of the European Commission, which it currently is.
On the subject of our socialist friends, let's have a question from Claire Stewart.
Evening. Is Jeremy Corbyn's sudden support for a second referendum just a cynical attempt to split the Conservative Party by ensuring that the European Research Group MPs split from the main party when the question on the ballot paper for such a second referendum does not include a clean break option? And what do you think the consequences of his decision will be for the Labour Party?
Well, there was an excellent article in today's Telegraph, your sister publication, saying that it was the your younger sister, I think.
They're all younger, yeah.
That it was the dead cat strategy, and that what you do is you throw a dead cat on the table so people talk about the second referendum rather than anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, which is the big problem that they're facing. And I thought that was a very interesting argument. What Labour has done is ignore its northern voting base. It said that their votes are less important than its metropolitan M25 voters. And I think this is a big risk for the Labour Party. I think it will alienate a lot of traditional Labour supporters. It is there to divert from current problems, from the independent group being formed. It's against how Jeremy Corbyn has always voted in Parliament when before he became leader, he was always in the division lobby with Bill Cash. He voted against every possible EU treaty. And if you read his speeches on the customs union, they make me look like an advocate of it. I mean, he couldn't have been more clear. So I think that Labour is moving away from its traditional supporters. And the idea that you should have a referendum which says, do you want to remain in the European Union or not really leave the European Union, would be an absolute disgrace. And I go back to what I was saying earlier. The only people who would benefit from that, because it's frankly dishonest, to say you can have a vote between not really leaving and not leaving at all is dishonest. And I think that would create real anger amongst the electorate and that voters would then vote for peculiar parties as a means of expressing that anger. They might even vote for the Liberal Democrats. No, not that. not that peculiar, no.
And what do you think the impact is of this new group, the independent group, or the Tiggers, as they're calling themselves? You saw three of your adversaries from the Tory benches leave and join them. Do you think we're beginning to see the splintering now of political parties, that in the same way that the Irish question once had this effect on British parties, that the European question might do the same to Labour and Conservatives?
Well, I wouldn't call the three who left my adversaries, that I disagreed with them on Europe. But last Friday, I went to speak in Greg Clark's constituency. It was very jolly. We did a call my bluff evening. And one of the words was floxynocky nihilopilification, which I knew what it meant. But the reason...
used in the House of Commons.
That's right.
It's got the record for the longest word ever pronounced.
And I'm a show-off, so I like to drop it into conversation whenever possible. The point about my doing this was that I spoke at the end of the evening about the things that Greg Clark and I agree on. And there is much more agreement within the Conservative Party than you might think, even if we disagree on the European Union. And Anna Soubry, as soon as she joined the independent group, made it clear that she believed that George Osborne's austerity policies were right. That's exactly my view. So I think... Europe is at the moment everything and will be until the 29th of March or conceivably the 30th of June. The difficulty for the independent group is that they've set themselves up essentially as an anti-Brexit party, and Brexit will be done or dusted within the next few months. And then what on earth have they got in common? What have they got to say? And I think this is a genuine difficulty for them.
But it is also a, look, Brexit, for the time being, is certainly a difficulty for the Conservative Party. And the next question, Monica McNeish, who's coming from Kent. Yeah.
Good evening. You mentioned that you thought the low wages was the reason that so many migrants came to this country to work and undercut local wages. So my first question is, why not just increase the minimum wage? And also, I completely agree with you that an open market and free competition is the best way. But why then stop the free movement of labour and the free movement of goods and services?
The second part of your question is logically absolutely right. That if you are a free trader, logically you should be in favour of the free movement of people as well. But you should allow the price to be set in the market, not set by the government. I think that would be really difficult because the draw of the United Kingdom to millions and millions of people across the world would simply be unsustainable. We couldn't possibly cope with those numbers. And that there is a need to maintain some continuity within society that would be threatened if you had millions of people coming in every year and you purely had a market labour rate. On the point about why not simply increase the minimum wage, well, I think it's better if wages rise because of market forces rather than because of government activity. But it doesn't solve the problem, because if you put up the minimum wage, you encourage more people to come from the rest of the European Union, and you don't change the competitive situation for the people who are already here, who may well therefore remain dependent on benefits which have to be funded by the taxpayer, rather than getting the lower skilled jobs that are attractive to the migrants coming in from the rest of the European Union. So I don't think it actually helps. I think what helps is having a work permit-based system that allows people to come in when you've identified a specific need, or allows people to come in to take higher paid jobs. There's no problem with people going to work in the city. That does not depress the wages of people in the city. Why? Because it's helped make the city the absolute bastion of global international finance of any place in the world. But it does depress low-skilled wages and makes it more difficult for the least well-off in our society to prosper. So that's why I think, although I absolutely accept your logic, there is a danger in politics of taking logic too far. You have to remember you're dealing with people's lives, and you have to have a responsibility for the people in this country's lives and help make them better, not to think that you can make them better for 7 billion people around the world.
You used to be quite against the minimum wage.
The minimum wage has clearly been a response to unlimited migration.
There's a living wage. I mean, soon the government's going to have one of the highest, effectively, minimum wages in Europe. And I'm trying to work out if you think that is a correct policy. And because I once thought, that if minimum wage went too high, unemployment would be the result. Classic economics would suggest that. But look at this country we live in now, where the minimum wage has never been higher, and nor has employment. It suggests that perhaps economic liberals have been wrong to think the minimum wage would be such a drag on employment. The minimum wage, I think, has been proved a success.
Up to a point, Lord Copper, because it's had the huge pool of labour from a high unemployment neighbour able to come in.
So it's made immigration larger?
Inevitably it's made immigration larger. It's been a big draw because the wages here have been higher than they would otherwise have been.
Right. Okay, now let's then move on to the European Research Group. They're having a meeting tonight, aren't they?
No, I left the meeting a couple of minutes early so I could vote quickly and then scoot over here. Well, not literally scoot, unless you scoot in a taxi, but you know what I mean. I wasn't using a Boris bike. We've had the meeting of the ERG earlier.
Okay, and what's the mood in the ERG after today's development? So you're beginning to think to yourselves, we've overreached a wee bit now, we might not get Brexit at all.
No, we don't think that. We're a positive bunch, we're optimistic. We think the country can be great and can prosper. And you know, there are two types of politician. There are those who are in politics really to manage decline and think, poor old Blighty's never been going to be as good as she was in the past, and the best we can do is make the decline a little bit gentler. And there are other types of politician who think that there's a real opportunity for this country to thrive, to make its own way in the world, to turn Brexit into this phenomenal enterprising success, and that's where the ERG is. And look, if 3 months' delay is the price we have to pay to get out properly, and it's the 30th of June, and to get rid of this deal that we've currently got that is deeply unsatisfactory, well, 3 months in the history of our great nation is a mere bagatelle. We can live with that. So we are very optimistic, and we will make sure that Brexit succeeds.
It's you. So it looks like you're preparing then to back a delay in Brexit.
Well, no, I'd be quite happy to leave without a deal, but I don't think we've got the votes in Parliament for it. The series of votes we're likely to have. We're likely to have another vote on the deal. I shall vote no. We're likely to have a vote on whether or not we should leave without a deal. I shall vote yes. We will then have a vote on, if we lose on that, we will then have a vote on should we extend, where once again I will vote no. I'm absolutely confident if we leave without a deal, we set our own tariffs, we set our own import regulations, we set our own immigration regulations. We are in charge of governing our country from 11 o'clock on the 29th of March. There is nothing to be frightened of. Hundreds of countries around the world govern themselves without the European Union telling them what to do and do quite well at it. We don't... And it's jolly reassuring. It's jolly reassuring that the Spectator readers aren't snowflakes. They seem to be they're stout-hearted Britons.
Right, but this argument, okay, outside this hall, I'm not quite sure you would get as big a cheer for that. And if you go to the House of Commons, people use phrases like cliff edge, economic suicide. The argument about a no-deal Brexit being nothing to fear is an argument that has not been properly made and regardless has anyway been lost. Even you accept that argument has been lost in the House of Commons. So it's not going to happen. It's academic. What they're cheering is never going to happen.
Well, it might happen, actually, but more by accident than by design. I accept it's not going to be government policy, but it may still happen. The argument in the House of Commons has neither been won nor lost. It just happens that there are 500 MPs who never wanted to leave the European Union and have consistently used Project Fear tactics to try and persuade people that we'll all be eaten by monsters in our beds. And it's all been wrong, hasn't it? Every last bit of it has been wrong. That they told us that we would have a recession. That was the governor of the Bank of England, who said he'd put interest rates up if we voted to leave. What did he do? He cut them. We were told by George Osborne that we would have a punishment budget and that unemployment would rise by 500,000 to 800,000. Unemployment has fallen and employment is at record levels. George Osborne set up the Office of Budget Responsibility because he thought the Treasury couldn't be trusted to make honest forecasts. The Treasury started making honest forecasts again over Brexit. Well, perhaps the word honest is misapplied. That the whole basis of Project Fear has been humbug, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating when the president of the Port of Calais came on to Radio 4 on the Today programme, and it was a glorious interview, and you can get it on electronic mechanisms to listen to again. And he was absolutely brilliant because he said it was offensive that the British were making all these preparations for delays in Calais. There weren't going to be any delays in Calais, and the interviewer on Radio 4 wasn't quite expecting this answer, as far as one can tell.
Okay, but staying on the ERG, a question from Tristan Allen, who's coming from Sevenoaks.
Hi there. It's generally considered that Theresa May's approach to Brexit has been littered with mistakes and errors, but how would you assess the ERG's approach and strategy of the last couple of years? And perhaps a score out of 10.
That's a very difficult question. It's always hard to mark one's own homework. I'm not going to give myself marks out of 10. Perhaps I should ask the audience. I thought you were allowed to do that on these sorts of shows. Well, that's who wants to be a millionaire? But I
actually think we've got your nanny in the audience somewhere here. Maybe she can mark the ERG out of 10.
Well, if nanny doesn't think we've done well, I'm lost. inevitably, in any political situation, one looks back and thinks it would have been better to have done things differently. I think we got the big issue of last year right, which was to get the Withdrawal Act through. And at that point, we were under a lot of pressure to be more aggressive and to stir things up a bit and so on. And we kept quiet because we thought if that act was through, that was absolutely crucial in building up to making sure that we got to the 29th of March. And at least we're having this row now rather than last June, finding that the act had been so amended that we didn't need to have this row. I misjudged the extent to which the Speaker would not be bound by precedent. And that is not a criticism of the Speaker. Because the Speaker argues that the House of Commons needs to debate what the House of Commons needs to debate, and I have a certain sympathy with that. I think he's gone a little further than I would have advised, and I think the clerks take that view as well, and I think that is what has got us to the position we're in. If it hadn't been for that, we would be leaving without a deal on the 29th of March. It's only been the unvoted on changes to standing orders that has allowed this to happen.
Okay. Next question from Eamon Gilmore from Northamptonshire. Can you clarify what research the ERG has conducted on the history of the European Commission's negotiation tactics? Was your research analysed and used to inform the government during negotiations? And if you didn't do any research, why not?
Research, we haven't been part of the negotiations. The research the European Research Group does is on the effect of the European treaties. When I was on the European Scrutiny Committee, the research group to which I've been a long-standing subscriber would provide me with detailed notes on all the matters coming before the committee and possibly even draft amendments to put down to committee reports. So the work we have to do as a parliamentary group is parliamentary research rather than general research on all matters European. It has to be tied into our parliamentary responsibilities, and the negotiating tactics of the European Union aren't really our parliamentary responsibilities.
Okay. And generally speaking, Brexit has been pretty divisive, would you say? Even, during North East Somerset was a Brexit constituency, but even there's hardly anywhere in the country where you will not find a family split by this. I mean, this polarization tends not to really happen very much in Britain. And there is a job of work, is there not, to do in repairing it. And how would you propose? Because it seems to me as if you're more focused right now on winning the battle and defeating the opposition than coming to some kind of language or approach that might heal the wounds of the referendum.
Well, I'm glad to say that all six of my children, including the one who wasn't born at the time of the election, was fully in favour of Brexit. So there's a united Rees-Mogg front on this issue. But your point is a very good one. We have to unite the country, party, families, after this is all finished. But that means we've got to leave. That's what will lead to people coming back together. Why do I say that? Well, it's what people voted for, and I think the frustration of those who voted to leave, if it isn't delivered upon, will be very great. I think a second referendum would be the most divisive thing you could do. It would turn... it would turn something that has split some communities into something that splits almost all communities, that people feel that they've had the vote, that it's been done. When you look at opinion polls, consistently 60 to 70% of people say that the results come in, it should be delivered. There's a relatively small number of diehard Remainers who are desperate to overturn it. But once it is delivered, we need to get on with other routine political discussions. We need to be talking about housing. We need to be talking about education. We need to be talking about crime. Did you see that 34,000 thieves are going to be released from prison under some government scheme? That's an extraordinary number. And nobody's taken any notice because we're all discussing the intricacies of Article 4 of the withdrawal agreement, and I can practically quote Article 4 at you. But when these terrible things in terms of crime are happening, surely we need to get back to debating the domestic issues.
Well, talking about those domestic, let's talk about the Conservative Party for a while. So those who have questions on the Conservative Party, stand ready. There isn't that much left of it now. Apart from Brexit, the Tory party has barely said a word about anything. Brexit has occupied the space where conservatism used to be.
I think that's regrettably true. I think that our whole political debate has been on Brexit, whether or the Labour Party or the Conservative Party. And that is a real problem because actually, ultimately, we will win elections if we make people's lives better. In Disraelian terms, improve the condition of the people. And we will do that because of the decisions that Brexit allows us to make, in part, but because we need to focus on domestic issues. And I don't much like the word bandwidth, but I'll use it for convenience's sake, that the bandwidth of the Conservative Party has been so taken up with Brexit that we are not talking about other things, and that is a pity, and we need to get on to talking about other things. And I understand, in an outbreak of non-Brexit conversation, I've had a leak from the highest parts of the Spectator that after the interval, when you've eaten your ice creams, we might discuss things other than Brexit.
Well, we can do so right now. Gregory Elwood-Hughes. I don't know if you've got the microphone Gregory Elwood-Hughes, if you can maybe work his way to that, but he's one of the people that is a bit concerned about, well, because there might be a general election, might there? One of the things about the independent group is it's given the Conservatives a 14-point lead in the YouGov poll. It's not impossible that we could have another general election. Not impossible Theresa May might lead the party into a general election.
What? There's a strange noise coming from the audience.
But if there was a snap election, there wouldn't really be time to find a new leader, not under your Tory rules. So it would be fighting another election with her as leader. Would you relish that?
The Prime Minister has said she will stand down before the next general election. So I take her at her word. But May I say a brief word against the Fixed Term Parliaments Act? It is such a constitutional monstrosity and is part of the reason we are in this awful muddle at the moment. First of all, it extended the period for elections, and that's why the last general election took so long. And that was part of the reason the Conservatives did poorly, was because it was too long a campaign, we weren't sufficiently focused. But much more importantly than that, the government does not command a majority in the House of Commons, it does not command a majority in the Cabinet, and yet is remaining the government. And this is constitutionally unprecedented, that if the government does not control Parliament, you have to have a new government. And that is why we are not having the level of decision-making on any issue, including on Brexit, that we ought to be having. Now, it has been a blessing, because there have been periods at which it looked as if the Tories would be hammered if we'd had a general election. But it has not been good for our form of government or for our constitution, and it all lies at the heart of the Fixed Term Parliament Act. And it also allows MPs to be slightly frivolous in how they vote. So if you take the defeat of 230 on the withdrawal agreement, what even would I have thought if, knowing that I'd voted against that withdrawal agreement, it had been a confidence vote, would have led to a general election, I would have lost the whip and would not have been allowed to stand as a Conservative in North East Somerset? That might have focused my mind. I might well have thought it was worth doing. But it wouldn't have been a defeat by 230 under those circumstances. And that's where the Constitution has been perverted by the Fixed Term Parliament Act, and the balance between the legislature and the executive has been upset in a way that does not lead to good government.
Okay, so Gregory Elwood-Hughes, Stuart King, Anushka Meany, or Joel Kern. Any of you guys got the microphone? If so, you can speak into it.
Good evening, Jacob.
Hello, good evening.
Who's this?
This is Gregory Elwood-Hughes. I'd like to know what positive reasons there are to vote for your party at the next general election, whenever that is, rather than just the negative reason for voting, which is to try to keep the socialist utopians out.
Well... Yes, or dystopians, as perhaps we should call them. What are the positive reasons? It's a very important question. What do I believe in as a Conservative? I believe that the best people to make decisions about their lives are individuals themselves, not the state. I think that leads to a better and stronger society, and lots of things flow from that. Why do I believe in low taxation? Ladies and gentlemen, because it's your money, of which the state should take the minimum necessary, because you will spend your money better than I can spend it for you. Now, if you want to send it to me, by all means, checks will be willingly received. But actually, you will make better choices about how you spend your money than the state will make for you. You will make better choices in education about the schooling that your children ought to have than the state will make for you. So I believe in a society that is strongest built from the bottom up, with families coming together to build society, to lead to government, rather than the top-down, the man in Whitehall really does know best approach of the socialist. I think it leads to better decision-making, better economic outcomes. It makes for a stronger, more bound together society, because society making decisions for itself is dependent upon itself. It doesn't feel that those decisions can be made by somebody else. Socialists always assume that somebody else will clear up your mess, will pick up litter that you've dropped in the street. Conservative society believes it's our responsibility to not drop litter in the first place. I haven't mentioned what I think is the key issue for Conservatives, which is housing. I believe that people should be able to own their own home. Now, sadly, I can't see this audience very well, but if I were to ask you, who of you under 35 would like to own his or her own house? Looking at this youthful audience, I imagine all your hands would go up. And that's really important, because that's what we have to provide. And why do we provide it? Because we think that people living in their own houses are invested in society and in a stronger position to make decisions for themselves about how society should organise. It is a social good, an economic good, oh, and it leads to Conservative government, so it's got a political benefit too.
Anushka Meany? We have a young Conservative, or except I thought we did, maybe not.
Yes, thank you very much.
Oh, excellent.
Evening, Mr. Easterog.
Evening.
With the launch of the new Brexit Party, as well as consistently strong campaigns from left-wing press groups like Momentum. How's the Conservative Party planning to attract both the youth vote as well as swing voters?
Well, to get the youth vote, I've had lots of children. That provides six. And I hope others will follow my lead. How do we do that? First of all, we have to go and talk to younger people. I speak as often as I can in universities. I didn't used to. I used to focus on conservative associations. But after the last election, I saw that Jeremy Corbyn was speaking to the younger generation, and the Conservatives were just silent. We had nothing to say to young people at the last election. We just thought they wouldn't bother to vote, so it didn't matter. You've got to go and talk to them. And what's so interesting is that when you say that I believe you should be in charge of your life rather than Jeremy Corbyn telling you what to do, people quite like that, particularly people of university age who have just left the tutelage of their schoolmasters and their parents and want to be in charge of their own lives. And so it's a good, strong Conservative message. And then you go on to saying, and the policies that flow from this view of Conservatism are X, Y, and Z, particularly, as I said before, housing. We need a message to give, but to all of society. Because it's the socialist who believes in dividing society up into a bag of interest groups and offering baubles to every interest group so that they will support you. But actually, our fundamental basis for policy, that the individual knows better than the state, is attractive to all ages. So the 90-year-old going into a care home ought to choose that care home, and the 19-year-old going to an education establishment ought to have responsibility for the fees for that educational establishment, because that person will benefit from that, but will also then be able to reap the benefit of that education and be more successful in later life because of that investment in their own future. I think those messages become very powerful if they are a message for the whole of society rather than specific baubles for different groups.
And will you be doing your bit to increase the Conservative youth vote by perhaps more children?
Well, I think my wife's in the audience, and I might get my first Rotten Tomato if I start saying...
You've actually got a wonderful quote from her here.
Oh, yes. there you are.
No septimus and no optimus. No.
That's right. You see, I try and create this image of a paterfamilias of a Victorian kind, and I'm afraid I'm a peon in my own home.
Okay, question from Jewel Kern in the Royal Circle.
So a follow-up to that young lady's question over there. So Labour has captured a large young audience who are much more proactive on social media. The Conservatives, I feel, have fallen behind in this. How is the party going to change to ensure that they continue to reach out and capture the future generations?
I don't know, actually. I do muddle about on social media a bit, but I'm very puzzled as to what people like and what they don't like. And you try different things, and some things that you think are not very exciting get retweeted thousands of times, and some things that you think are really fascinating, nobody's in the least bit interested in at all. So I'm not an expert on how to do it. I recognise it's important. I think from the party's point of view, you just have to hire in the best people. How did we do so well in 1979? Do you know, I was only 10 in 1979, actually 9 before the general election. I can still remember some of those campaign slogans. My favourite was, if Labour's the answer, it must have been a silly question. And that's a slogan you can use again and again at every election. And I remember one of the party political broadcasts. I must have been a really boring 9-year-old, but never mind, I can... I'm probably a boring 49-year-old too, but leave that to one side. I remember the party political broadcast of runners on the track, and there was the Union Jack on this chap, and he was running, he was ahead, and somebody came and put a weight on him, and then another weight on him, and he fell behind further and further. How did we get those messages out? Was it because MPs knew how to do it? No, it wasn't. It's because we hired the best people. We hired Saatchi and Saatchi to do it, and they were able to get a message formed, crafted, in a way that what we wanted to say was put across to the electorate. So I think you have to bring in the best people who are experts in their field. And frankly, what MPs are doing is fun, but it's inevitably amateurish.
So what social media do you prefer, then? What's your weapon of choice?
Well, the jolliest social media is Instagram, which is great fun.
and people are so charming.
We've actually got one of your Instagram pictures up here. This is one that you shared, an article you shared. Jacob Rees-Mogg sent from 1923 to save the Conservative Party.
Yes. Yes, but 1923 is really very modern. Surely I've come from a proper century, but never mind.
But this is, but people have a laugh, that's the idea.
It's fun, isn't it, social media? That's the point. And you can make some serious political points, but it all ought also to be amusing. And Instagram's really charming because people put nice, friendly replies on. Twitter's a bit more rebarbative, and one doesn't necessarily want to read all the comments.
Okay, well, on the subject of sociability, let us pause now for the break. Do email questions if they strike you. We'll be doing non-Brexit stuff in the second half. See you at the bar, and I think Jacob's going to be selling some ice creams at the end. Thank you.
We shuffle off.
Well, welcome back. I hope a lot of you had a chance to buy some ice cream from Jacob there. It took him 32 quid at halftime, he tells me, so he'll invest it and become very rich and bail us out of Brexit one day. Right. Let us... we've got a lot of questions, and so many at halftime. And I can't think of another politician who would attract so many questions about religion. And we've had a lot of them. And I'll paraphrase what a lot of people have asked, which is to ask just how important is Catholicism in your life and to what extent does it shape your political views?
Catholicism is very important to my life, I believe in the teaching of the Catholic Church, I believe in the resurrection, and that all that flows from that I accept. The catechism and the dogma of the Catholic Church. And I believe that there will be life everlasting, which is quite important. So it is an enormous background to the rest of my life. It's an important part of family life. And then how does it relate to political life? Well, only in one respect, really, and that is that there is a requirement that individuals should do what they can, essentially. I mean, I paraphrase the gospel teaching, but that if you think of the parable of the rich man who goes away and he leaves the parable of the talents, that you're meant to do with your talents what you can. You're not meant to bury them in a field and do nothing with them. And so that is an important motivator for public life because it's about doing what I can in the fields that I'm involved in. I don't have a hotline to Rome for every vote on matters of Brexit. That the church's position is in relation to the moral issues and into what you might call truth with a capital T. It is not into whether VAT should be 20% or 19.5%. That is not a matter of infallible doctrine. But whether there was the resurrection, whether Christ rose again on the third day, and whether through that we are saved, is a matter of infallible doctrine.
So what issues... where do you draw the line, then? And what issues do you, to use your words, take your whip from Rome?
I take my whip from Rome on issues that are fundamentally moral issues or sacramental issues. So... the sacrament of marriage is as determined by God, not by man. And this was actually exactly the argument that Thomas More had with Henry VIII. He said, an act of Parliament cannot change the sacrament. Mm-hmm. And I believe that. An act of Parliament cannot overrule God. I believe in the sovereignty of Parliament, in case you misunderstood me, but God is not subject to the sovereignty of Parliament. He is a non-voting member. And... more importantly still, matters of life. Life belongs to God, not to man. And life begins at the point of conception, and it goes on until natural death. And that is something that is sacred and valuable, and the individual soul is valuable. And this informs my other beliefs. What I was saying earlier on about how the Conservative thinks that it is the individual that is important, I believe that every individual is of equal importance because their soul is loved by God. And this is only relevant really in language. I greatly dislike the term ordinary people because there is no such thing as an ordinary person. I wish I could look out and actually see you, but it's so bright I can't. But not one of you sitting here is ordinary. Each one of you has a soul that is loved by God. You are special in that sense. And if you're special to God, you ought to be special to your elected representatives, all the more so. And that underpins everything that I want to do politically, because it is about these 70,000 people in Somerset who are not ordinary people, but are brilliant, driven, interesting people who have hopes and ambitions much as anybody else does, much as politicians do, and whose lives, if they can be made a bit better by what I do, that is then a noble calling.
But in the first half, you were telling us about asking you to describe your conservatism, that conservatives believe in bottom-up societies, in letting people do what they want with their lives, that you know far better what to do with your life than I know. Yet you will oppose laws that grant freedom for equal marriage. You've got, there are some liberal strands of Judaism, some Unitarian churches who wish to have same-sex marriages. Should religious freedom not be extended to them so they can do what they want? And who are you, as a Catholic, to say that other religions, or even people of other non-religions, should organise their affairs in any other way?
My concern is about the sacrament of marriage and is essentially one of terminology. The sacrament cannot be changed by statute, but how people wish to arrange their lives is a matter for them. I don't want to tell anybody how to lead his or her life.
You voted against gay marriage.
I did, because it was trying to say that a sacrament was something different. It was talking about marriage. The issue of partnerships and how people arrange their lives is purely a matter for them and their own conscience. But marriage is a sacrament that comes from God, and Parliament doesn't have the right to change marriage.
Wait, Catholics believe marriage is a sacrament that comes from God.
Well, so do Anglicans, and we still have a state religion.
But there are a great number of people who are not religious who also believe in marriage. They just don't believe that God is involved in it because they don't believe in God.
Then the state should have legislated in a way that avoided the sacramental issue, and that's basically one of definitions. I have no objection to how people choose to lead their lives, but marriage is sacramental and therefore is not a secular authority.
Right. Question from Abby Holdsworth, please. Abby Holdsworth.
Hi. What would your reaction be if one of your children decided to marry a same-sex partner?
Well, the eldest is only 11, so this issue is a little way off. I think one always has a love for one's children, and one's children will make choices, and they must make those choices informed of the teaching of the Catholic Church, which I shall make sure they are informed of. The lucky things get to listen to the catechism on Sunday lunchtimes, but only when we don't have guests. I don't inflict the catechism on our guests at Sunday lunch.
Right. You've been questioned quite a lot on abortion. And there is, on Piers Morgan, perhaps that was the one that got the most attention, where you were asked, do you oppose abortion in cases of rape or incest? And you basically said that you did. But rather, you didn't quite say that. You said you agree with the teaching of the Church, but the Church prohibits it in all these circumstances. And I, Jacob Rees-Mogg, do not judge, because the Bible says, don't judge, lest not that ye should be judged. But isn't that a little bit of a get-out clause there? You're not really saying whether you agree with the Church here. You're saying us Catholics aren't supposed to, ours is not to reason why, ours is just to do what the Church says. But that's not what the Catholic Church says. The Catholic Church says you ought to be able to intellectually defend all of the Church's position. So are you not wimping out a bit here?
No, I think you're confusing two different things, if I may. That the teaching of the Catholic Church I accept as authoritative, and I'm very happy to argue as to why it may or may not be right. But it's not then for me to judge others who don't follow the teaching of the Church. Those aren't the same thing. I don't want to judge people who find themselves in extraordinarily difficult circumstances that I cannot imagine. That is not right. But it is right for me to say that life begins at the point of conception, and that all life is valuable. And therefore, the life that is created in the womb ought to have some standing when these issues are being considered. It is not purely about the woman's life and the woman's rights. There is a new life as well, and that life must and deserves to be protected.
Okay. Now, your views, you're saying, are of no, not different at all to the standard Catholic views. And yet, when your average person describing Jacob Rees-Mogg, they say he's got these extreme views on religion. We saw that on a placard. I don't know if you saw the welcoming committee we had earlier on. We had somebody dressed up as a nun, I think. And her point was, I think she used the phrase religious extremist. Now, that might be a little bit harsh, but you'll be familiar with the line of argument that you have views which are basically not acceptable in the liberal, in the contemporary mainstream, that your views are often extreme.
I would dispute that. I have very standard views in accordance with the teaching of the Catholic Church, which has over a billion members across the globe. So me and a billion extremists. It's even more than the 17.4 million I agree with on Brexit. And I get accused of being an extremist for that as well. I think it's a term that gets bandied about by people who don't want to engage in any intellectual argument.
Next question from Andrew Tucker, please.
Good evening, and thank you for that last answer. It's outstanding. So Tim Farron, in resigning as leader of the Liberal Democrats, suggested that it wasn't feasible or credible for an Orthodox practicing Christian to lead one of the mainstream parties these days. Do you agree?
No, I think it's not true. You can't lead the Liberal Democrats, but that's hardly a mainstream party nowadays. The Liberal Democrats just aren't liberal. And they hounded David Alton out of their party, whatever it was 20 years ago, for his very standard Catholic views. They hounded out Tim Farron. The Conservative Party, in this sense, is a much more liberal party. And I'm very lucky. I do appreciate that. I think being a Conservative and a Christian is extremely compatible. There is no pressure within the Conservative Party to hide your religion or to adopt a secularist agenda. There is enormous pressure in the Lib Dems and some pressure in the Labour Party, and I actually hugely admire Labour Christian members of Parliament who sometimes have to put their faith above their political advancement. And it's a genuine problem in the Labour Party, whereas I think in the Conservative Party it isn't. As you see with our Prime Minister, who is a very devout Anglican, with the views that you would expect a devout Anglican to have, and that's been no harm to her.
Well, can we just say that she is a daughter of a vicar, but she hardly ever talks about her religious views. And the many religious politicians I know also don't talk about their religious views, because if they do, in the way that you do, they get the reaction that you get.
Well, and I only get the reaction from a nutter who dresses up as a nun. I mean, you know. Look, you can't please all of the people all of the time, and there are some nutters about. I'm not appealing to the nutter vote. I'm appealing to the good, honest people of North East Somerset to vote for me, who are very sane.
Okay. Now, you spoke earlier on about your view of politics when you were about 9 or 10 years old. You had a public profile back then. How did that come about?
Entirely by accident.
You didn't look unusual when you were 11 years old?
No more unusual than I look now. Yes, well, I think that's photoshopped. I don't think I had a monocle. I don't know where. I did have that camel haired coat. My father had one. I thought it was frightfully smart. I think, in retrospect, it was an error of taste.
Right. But you were, you know, when I was researching this interview, I was amazed to find out how the views of the 11-year-old Jacob Rees-Mogg were fairly well documented. I also had the great pleasure of meeting on the way in, as I was welcoming many of you here, every fourth person I stopped seemed to be a member of your family. You wonder how you sold out this place
right.
so quickly, actually.
How else do you fill the Palladium unless you've got a large family?
And I had the great honour of meeting your mum, who told me about how you got involved in investing very early on. And so, you know, you inherited 50 quid, and you had the choice of spending this on sweets or toys or investing it. You chose to invest it. And within about a year, you were at the annual meeting of, was it General Electric?
Was, yes.
Complaining about their dividend policy wasn't generous enough.
Yes. That's right. Yeah, that's absolutely true. Certainly, in terms of the investment, I was very much guided by my father. I didn't at that point know a great deal about individual companies, but I did know that I had this £50 in General Electric, and I got about a 50p dividend, and I thought that was a bit pathetic when they had cash reserves of £1 billion. I thought they should be paying it out to shareholders. I still do, actually. They should have done. And I did go along to the AGM and say the dividend was pathetic. That is correct. What else was I to do? I am, after all, a capitalist.
You also had a kind of life plan at that age as well. I think we've got another quote about when you're 11 years old, how you described your life plan. You said that you wanted to be a millionaire at 20, a multimillionaire at 40, and Prime Minister at 70 when I've made enough money to afford to waste some in politics.
I think it's a little unfair to dredge up comments I made as an 11-year-old.
Well, I don't know. I think it's going according to plan so far.
It's a different millennium.
But so far, so good. I don't know how much you're earning, but 20. You're probably a multimillionaire now.
I'm a mere pauper. I have to sell ice creams in the interval to keep make ends meet.
Okay. But you did read the Financial Times from a very young age.
I still do read the Financial Times, and it's almost penance nowadays, because I read all these... I've read the Financial Times pretty much every day for a very long time, and it gets more and more painful to do as it gets more and more left-wing.
Okay. But this this sort of childhood habit of investing is one that you never quite lost. You have been investing ever since, and you've now got your own company, Somerset Capital Management. So this is... Tell us a bit about that.
Well, I set up Somerset Capital Management with some partners in 2007.
You're working out in Hong Kong?
I'd been in Hong Kong for a bit, from 93 to 96, came back to England with Lloyd George Management, who I worked for 14 years, and then a group of us at Lloyd George set up on our own and set up Somerset Capital Management, which is an emerging markets boutique investment house. And I'm not running it anymore. I'm the non-executive chairman, and I go in... And see what's happening, but I'm not running the business and sadly not running the funds anymore, because the most interesting part of fund management is unquestionably managing the money and making those decisions on a daily basis. Also, in investment management, you know the next day whether you've got it right or not, whereas in politics, you've got a slightly longer time horizon.
Okay. Now, next question came in at the interval from Adam Kulik, who's in K32 in the stalls. That's yours, Adam?
There we go.
Yep, there you are.
Hi. A couple of questions, I guess. One of which is, obviously, you make a very passionate argument for the economic benefits of Brexit over a long period of time, 50 years. The pound rose today on the potential for a Brexit delay. And I guess a part of your argument is that we would have cheaper costs of goods for people to buy. Critics might say, given that we import a number of items which are necessary for most people to live, that they would be interested to hear how you reconcile a lower pound with less inflation.
Well, the pound has fallen. There's been no inflation. So that's just how the economy has worked. But lowering the price of imports because you're receiving them from more competitive sources is an automatically beneficial thing to do. We pay a high price for our imports because so many of our imports come from an uncompetitive closed European market. We protect a very large number of businesses that we don't even have, or where we do have them, we protect inefficient continental businesses to compete with businesses that may be inefficient in the UK as well. This is not at all a sensible system of arranging an economy.
Okay. Your company operates from Singapore and also has a subsidiary in the Cayman Islands, both of which are tax havens.
No, Singapore is no longer a tax haven. The corporation tax rate in Singapore is almost exactly the same as the corporation tax rate in the UK.
Right, but the Cayman Islands?
The Cayman Islands...
What first attracted you to the zero tax Cayman Islands?
The Cayman Islands is not a profit centre for Somerset Capital Management. We make no money in the Cayman Islands at all. Zero. It is a jurisdiction for funds that are sold around the world so that they have the same basis for every investor when returning to their own jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. We do not make even a pound out of Cayman Islands. It is purely there to have pooled vehicles that are the same for everybody globally. That's the purpose of it.
Right. And how much of your time now as a politician is taken up?
About 30 hours a month.
For which you're paid?
It's in my declaration of interest if anyone wants to look it up.
We'll look it up. It's £500 an hour.
Well, you wouldn't get a lawyer for that. Also, it's basically irrelevant. I'm not paid on an hourly basis. I'm paid because I set up the business. And when I set up the business, we had no money under management, £0. We now have $7 billion under management. If you create a business that employs 50 people, has an office in Singapore and an office in London, I think you deserve to be paid for it. I'm a capitalist. And Not only do I not apologise for it, I'm proud of Somerset Capital Management. It's one of the most important things that I've done. Well, I'm going to continue, actually, because the audience is so kind. When I set up Somerset Capital Management with my partners, we operated from the basement of my house in London. We didn't have an office, and the first few months' salaries I paid out of my own bank account. You are entitled, when you take that risk of setting up a business, to make money out of it. If people don't do that, we have no prosperity in this country.
Well, certainly, if the electorate here would, you know, applaud you, it's your company, you make lots of money out of it, quite right too, we need wealth creators. But you're a politician, and you will know that in politics, there will be people asking questions like the one that's about to come from Maurice McLeod.
No.
Maybe your last answer was such a...
Hello. Hello, Mr. Rees-Mogg. So you've said earlier that you're not necessarily a fan of things like the minimum wage. You've also supported a government that, for the last 10 years, has seen public sector workers like teachers and nurses have their pay basically frozen so that some of them end up in food banks. Now, what is it? I'm no economist, so I'm asking you because you're very learned. What exactly is it you do that you think makes you worth 30 nurses?
It's a completely irrelevant comparison. It's nothing to do with being worth anything. It's what is produced by the company that you have and therefore the value that comes from that company. And I think your question misfires that actually salaries in the health system and in education have gone up. They have gone up, and people have gone up in increments within the bands in which they are employed. So, yes, if you haven't moved increment since 2010, you haven't had any single promotion, then, yes, your salary would have been broadly flat. But actually, in the health service, I think on average over that period, salaries have gone up by slightly over 3%, so over inflation. They haven't, in fact, been frozen. And that in terms of the minimum wage, the minimum wage has become necessary because we kept wages down by high levels of immigration. I'm in favour of the market setting a wage that is actually higher than the minimum wage, is what I think the market would do if the market were left to function. So the minimum wage is there because of market dysfunction, because of other policy choices. But I'm all in favour of people in this country becoming more prosperous. And the way to do that is to have wealth creation. The way to do that is to have people who set up businesses. And that requires people to take a risk.
Right. But as a free marketeer, you will have been struck about how outside the wonderful confines of this room, there is quite a lot of concern about capitalism. You and I might have thought somebody like Jeremy Corbyn would be doomed to fail in the polls. And in fact, at the last general election, he increased his votes more than any other leader of any other party since the war. So his agenda, radical, dystopian, whatever we want to describe it, you and I cannot describe it as unpopular.
No, I wouldn't begin to. It's always popular to say, I'll give you somebody else's money. I think we're using the wrong terminology. I think we should use free markets rather than capitalism, because I think capitalism very quickly becomes the CBI world of crony capitalism, protecting businesses of the electricity companies who routinely treat their customers poorly. Of the worst company I deal with for my constituents is British Telecom, because it remains a quasi-monopoly, and it doesn't care when you write in on behalf of a constituent. They really don't care. I think I've only once had to write to a supermarket, and that tells you as much as you need to know to start with. And when supermarkets get a complaint, they take it really very seriously. Why? Because it's very competitive. What we need are competitive free markets, not crony capitalism. And I'm very, very pleased that the brilliant Andrew Tyrie, Lord Tyrie as he now is, has taken over the Competitions and Markets Authority and is saying he wants to be the champion for consumers, because we need to break up those oligopolies that lead to higher prices and lack of competition and poor service to customers. That's proper conservative free marketeering rather than crony capitalism. I think we need to divide the two up.
But it is difficult to describe the system, free markets, capitalism, call it what you may, when your average wage is still pretty much where it was 10 years ago. And you talk about nurses' wages having been improved, but I think Maurice McLeod said you earn 30 times what a nurse worth. I think the average employee is on £14.30 an hour. That is, roughly speaking, where it was 10 years ago. Something is going wrong, quite badly wrong. And we also mentioned housing earlier on. You've got a whole generation that doesn't think, but that basically looks at these stagnant salaries, that works out that they are not paid that much more than what their parents were at the same age. Their experience has been of salary stagnation and of a system that's not working. And no matter how much you might applaud the model and the potential of the free market, it has not been the experience of a lot of young voters.
Well, it's because it hasn't been a free market. Housing is run by the state. It's a planned process back to the 1947 Town and Country Planning Act that thinks the state can plan and provide housing, which it has routinely failed to do. We've got to build more houses and we have to free up the system. Ladies and gentlemen, a lot of us who have nice views have to accept that houses are going to need to be built so that our children and our grandchildren can afford to live in them. And that is a natural human aspiration, and we should be supporting it, and we should allow more building. But it's worse than that, because the system of planning is so expensive that the only people who can get planning permission are the big builders, because they can afford to lose in one area and gain in another. A medium-sized builder cannot afford the hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of costs that it takes to put through a planning application if it won't work. And so we've created an oligopoly that puts up prices, leads to a constraint in supply because they do it according to their convenience, not to consumers' convenience, and is controlled by the state. We need to be opening it up. In terms of the economy, well, Is it coincidence that we are getting up to the highest level of tax of GDP as we've seen in this country since Harold Wilson was Prime Minister? Or do you think that might be part of the reason why people haven't been getting better off, because the state is taking too much of it and spending it badly?
And what does... Look, the audience agrees with you, but who are they going to vote for? What party are they going to vote for that's going to take the tax down? And don't say it's the Conservative Party, because your Chancellor, Philip Hammond, proposes taking the highest tax burden for 35 years and making it even higher.
Philip Hammond is no doubt in many ways a very great man. But I think it will have to be the Conservative Party. Let's take stamp duty. Stamp duty revenues have begun to go down because they are at ridiculous rates and have been strangling the London property market. And this is a great error, because the London property market is our window on the world. It needs to be open to the world. It needs to draw in individuals and capital from around the world. And putting on up to 15% stamp duty is completely crazy, and is why the revenue has stopped and the housing market has stagnated. The way to get the property market going is not to try and squeeze off demand by making everything too expensive or too heavily taxed, but by increasing supply. That is the challenge, and actually that's what you would do in a free market. When there is a shortage of supply, you create more. You don't try and squeeze demand.
But when it comes to public spending, I mean, right now the defence budget isn't exactly overflowing. What would you cut? Because you'd have to.
Let's start with the easy one. £10 billion a year that we don't have to spend to the European Union. And £12 billion a year that you don't have to spend on overseas aid. I would reduce that by half. And I read reports that HS2 has gone from £35 billion to £100 billion. Now, I did vote for HS2 in the House of Commons, but you're quite right, it was a shame. The reason I did was I thought you can't vote against your party on too many things at once. And I was voting against quite a lot when HS2 came through. But even if it were right then, it is not right now. The cost has got out of control, and that £100 billion should be saved.
Okay. Now, if the Conservatives are to try to get a better year, because let's face it, the Conservatives are in a pretty bad place right now, you've got a party which is not just split in Europe, but it's split in things like this as well. I mean, there's a Tory... We know every Tory budget after Tory budget, we see policies opposite to the ones that you do. I doubt your party will do anything about HS2 as well. Well, we'll see, perhaps under new leadership. It doesn't seem to be able to remedy itself. And you yourself said fairly recently that when the party goes through its various fits, its periodic fits, where it tries to get a new leader, it tends to do itself great damage. Now, we had the moment of truth where the Conservatives tried to make a pitch, let's get rid of Theresa May and replace her with something else. It didn't work. And it does, I wonder if it makes you wonder if the Conservatives are ever really going to remedy it. Because it's all very well sitting here and making speech and saying things that you know the audience is going to applaud. But the chances of that really making its way into the next Tory party manifesto, the Tory party is losing, isn't it, the original drive which drew its support in the first place?
No, I don't think that's right, and I think you get policies adopted by making the arguments. So coming in front of this audience and discussing these things is very important, because policies adapt to meet what there is clearly a public demand for. And if the case is made that these are the right things to do, then they will change and develop, and a different leader might adopt them in a different way. That if you look at where Tory party policy was before Margaret Thatcher took charge, it was a Butskillism, essentially. He went away from it for a year or two. And Margaret Thatcher completely changed the terms of trade. Why? Because she'd come to believe these arguments. She'd come to believe that free markets would actually work. She believed in monetary policy. And that was crucial to changing the fortunes of the nation in 1979. It can be done, but it requires quite exceptional leadership.
Okay. And the method of selling it, I mean, do you see in the hall tonight some signs of interest in the sort of conservatism? I mean, do you think there's anything beyond a lot of people coming to cheer you on tonight?
I said earlier, it's very interesting speaking in universities. A conservative message does engage with people. It is interesting. And that, I think, is the beginnings of getting things to change. But there's been a problem in British politics, which... Well, shall I answer the question? Because that covers what is going to be changed. But the Conservatives need to change back to what we do at our best, which is to be a party of low taxation and less...
Okay, I think the question is, what will you change? Yeah.
What will change? And I'm sorry to cut you off, but it's quite difficult.
I think he's quite trying to answer, I think.
It's quite difficult to hear you. Anyway, thank you very much for your helpful contribution. It is very important that the Conservatives don't get tied in by what has happened really since Tony Blair has been in charge, mm-hmm. which was the coming together of the parties and a feeling that however you voted, you would get pretty much the same. I think that has been deeply unsatisfactory and is part of the reason for the success of Jeremy Corbyn, because it was different, it was fresh, well, fresh in a rather stale way, but nonetheless, and that the Conservatives need to re-identify as being conservative rather than part of a Tony Blairite mush in the middle.
Yeah. And,
when we first met,
yes.
I think you said to me that to get to Thatcher you had to go through Heath, and that was a reference of yours to mm-hmm. David Cameron. I was defending David Cameron at the time, but I think you thought that Cameron was a route to Thatcherism and not Thatcherism in its own. And I think the coalition did some very important things, and austerity was necessary, but it was never able to follow, even if it had wanted to follow, a conservative approach to the economy.
Question from Francis Osborne on a grave matter of state.
Good evening, Mr. Rees-Mogg. Were you born in that suit, and do you have anything else to wear?
Yes and no. I've got a number of other very similar suits. Some are grey and some are dark blue, and I find that very satisfactory for almost all occasions.
You wore them to university as well, I gather.
Well, not this suit. This suit isn't quite that old, but it's amazing how long suits will last. If you know, it's good economy to have suits that last. But yes, I wore double-breasted suits at university.
I've once seen you in a single-breasted one.
Yes, I have one or two. I don't often wear them. They're a bit too modern, really.
Right. Is it true? A few things which, when I was researching, I didn't know if they were true or false. Is it true that you campaigned with your nanny and your Bentley in Fife?
No.
I didn't think it would
be. But nanny definitely came to campaign in Central Fife. Many members of my family have joined me on the campaign trail wherever I've been campaigning, and Nanny is my secret weapon, because when she knocks on people's doors, it's rather than having some pushy politician, it's somebody being absolutely charming and saying, oh, I'm just here to ask if you might be supporting the Conservatives, rather than, will you support them on a scale of 1 to 10? You know, all that stuff we're meant to do when campaigning. And Nanny does it beautifully and wins me more votes than almost anybody of a more political hue. My mother also canvassed for me, as was my wife, my children. It is a family affair.
And the Bentley?
No. I did have a Bentley. I've had a Bentley for a very long time. It belonged to Gubby Allen, who some of you will remember, a famous England cricketer. And it came up in a book auction, and my father was a great book collector, and he saw it and egged me on to buy it. And I still have it. It periodically goes. It's a very nice car, but I never took it up to Scotland.
Is it true that in spite of having six children, you've never changed a nappy?
I have never changed a nappy, no.
Look, you get applauded for that, so savour that applause, I think, you know.
Well,
unlikely to happen again. Well, why not? Six kids.
Well, I don't think Nanny would think I was competent at it. I mean, I have to say, I think being let loose in that department would see a raised eyebrow from the Nanny quarter.
Okay. Is it true that you have never cried as an adult?
I have never cried as an adult.
Not even when reading Theresa May's Brexit deal?
That was a close-run thing.
Okay. Is it true that you've changed the last four digits of your phone number to 1649 to commemorate the death of Charles I?
I've moved house, so it's sadly no longer true, and I couldn't get 1649 on the 222 extension. But otherwise, yes, that is broadly true. But
talk us through that. Come on. Okay. I mean, that's quite a hassle changing your phone number.
No. It was when I moved into the house and had the telephone connected, and you can ask for a number at that point. And it's important to have telephone numbers that people can remember. So if you say to people, 495, the death of Charles I, they know exactly what to call. They only have to remember the 495 bit. And so that was the purpose of having it.
Okay.
Because I'm worried. Don't tell me Spectator readers don't immediately know the data. There must be some people in from the New Statesman.
Right. Well, there's something else here that I think is actually even wee more extreme than never changed a nappy, that you've never washed up.
Well, there's a washing machine.
Are you in the habit of stacking and unloading that machine?
Not routinely, no.
Okay, we have the great honour of having Nanny in the audience tonight, actually. So
yes, Nanny will come next week, and we'll answer further questions.
She'll probably sell out in 1 week, actually.
Nanny will sell out very fast.
Yeah, okay. And that's... Right, you once harangued a manager about a bonus at your own wedding.
No, that's not true.
I didn't think you'd do anything as rude as that. Right, that you once said that Theresa May is absolutely brilliant and will do a fabulous job.
Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea maxima culpa.
Okay. Next question, Sophie Jarvis, if we can get a... because some of these questions actually have been about... People have been asking about each other. They're trying to work out what is this Mog mania. And I once met a chap at the Conservative Party conference who was such a fan of yours that he had your name tattooed on his chest. And if you don't believe me, the BBC did a picture of it. I think we've got a picture of this here. I don't know, we'll see if we can get it on the slide here. It was Mogmentum or something like that.
Yes, he was a bit...
Here we are.
That's right. He came to see me. I gave him tea in the House of Commons, but I'm glad to say he didn't show me the tattoo. I thought that would have been a little informal.
So what's going on?
Well, you better
I wouldn't ask if anybody's got a tattoo here. You don't strike me as a tattooing type. But it is, do you feel that you've got a bit of momentum, not momentum, but momentum, and you might be getting back to what your 11-year-old self said of having ambitions for office? Now, I've heard every time you ask this question saying, I'm quite happy to be the MP for North East Somerset. But if you were forced to choose a cabinet job, what would it be?
Well, I'm not going to be forced to choose a cabinet job. I mean, can you
imagine, if you were offered one.
Can you imagine what Theresa May would think about that suggestion? I mean, she'd have to have a lot more resignations before I came anywhere. I'm going to give you the same answer. I love being the Member of Parliament for North East Somerset. I think being a Member of Parliament is such an exciting honour. That thought that you're representing 70,000 of your fellow citizens is just terrific. I love it. I'm so privileged to be able to do it. And I hope they'll keep on voting for me.
So, okay. A question from Sophie Jarvis.
Well, I think Fraser, you sort of you asked it yourself. But what is it, Jacob, that you think it is about you that drives someone to tattoo themselves with that on their nipple?
Well, I think it was gin, probably. But I
look. Well, you woke up the next morning thinking, "My God,
what have I done?" Yes. Sometimes people's friends play the most awful tricks on them. I just don't know. I think it amuses people and keeps them out of other mischief. Just think, there's very good advice in a Woodhouse book, which is that you should never tattoo the name of a girl on your arm, because if the girl changes, it's frightfully awkward. If she's called Susan and then you marry somebody called Helena, it's a bit embarrassing. And I think this is better, therefore, to have Mogmentum, because unless he becomes a communist, it's not going to cause him embarrassment in his future life.
Next question from Bina Pandit, please, about whether the word is... Bina, ask a question.
Good evening, Jacob.
Good evening.
Jeremy Corbyn's followers are called Corbynistas. I tell my friends I am a Moggy. Do you approve? What name would you prefer?
Oh, I'm honoured that anyone should take any name of that kind. I have no preference, because it's wonderfully unexpected but very gracious of you to call yourself a Moggy. I hope it doesn't turn out to be a catastrophic mistake. I mean, we are at the Royal Palladium, the London Palladium, after all. So, I've got to tell terrible jokes occasionally.
And what about... do you like this stage? Are you enjoying yourself tonight?
Well, it's because I'm in such fine company. That's why it's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I saw at halftime, we have Andrew Lloyd Webber in the audience tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and I wonder if he's eyeing you up for a residency.
Well, I'm very glad his lordship is here, who is a very great man. So if he really is here, he is one of the most respected conservative figures in this country, and an enormously successful businessman, too.
Now, next question from...
We've also got one of my colleagues here. Steve Baker is here, which I think really is... He has to...
Well, we'll do it next week.
Now...
Okay.
He's the real power behind the ERG. I just do as I'm told.
Well, perhaps he might be tempted to answer... No, I'll get you to answer the next one from Maximilian Dunmore.
Which scenario would you prefer? A clean Brexit, but Corbyn wins 2022, or Brexit, but a proper Conservative wins 2022?
Or no Brexit in the comments.
If we don't deliver Brexit, that is how Corbyn wins. So this isn't avoiding the question, but if the Conservative Party, where 70% of our voters back Brexit, and the overwhelming majority of our members support Brexit, fails to deliver Brexit, our voters will not turn out at the next election, and Jeremy Corbyn will win by default. So the either-or just doesn't work. It's not deliver Brexit and get Corbyn, or fail and remain Conservative. It's if we fail, Corbyn wins, and Conservatives should be worried about that, even frightened about that.
Okay. But realistically, if you were to, you know, where would you say that we're going to be? Not where would you like us to be, but where do you think we will be in 3 months' time?
Not at the London Palladium.
Lord Webber will keep you on a...
It's very hard to predict the precise timings of Brexit. I think we will leave. It is not impossible that we leave on the 29th of March and that we leave with a deal that has some change to the backstop. I, as I was saying earlier, think that the mood of the country is still very strongly that we must deliver on the referendum result, and that very few politicians are brave enough to say directly that they oppose Brexit. They want to do it by legerdemain, and I don't think ultimately that will work. And so I think we will be out of the EU midway through the cricket season.
Right. But would we be out? I mean, because let's face it, Theresa May's withdrawal agreement is not really being out of the EU, is it? Even if it were to be given with a backstop, we would still be obeying all of the EU laws. And you would find it hard to say, with a hand on heart, that we are now no longer members of the EU. Technically, we wouldn't be members of it, but we'd have to obey all of the rules, all of the regulation, and Brexit is something that may or may not happen in 2 years' time. But let's not fool ourselves that Brexit is really on the cards.
There are many bits of the withdrawal agreement that I don't like beyond the backstop, but they all end. The implementation period ends, and yes, we would be the vassal state during the implementation period, and yes, we would continue to make large contributions to the EU, but all of that would finish. We would cease being the vassal state by the end of 2020. The major bulk of the payments would have ended by 2022. There would be a long but small tail going on. And that's what really matters. So that I can live with. I don't like it. I don't pretend I like those bits of it. But it all goes. There may be some ECJ involvement in citizens' rights for an 8-year period after we've finally left. But again, that goes. The problem with the backstop is that it doesn't go. And that's what makes it so particularly objectionable. But if we've been in the EU now for 47 years, I can live with 21 months of vassalage. What I can't live with, what I can't vote for, is a further indefinite period of taking rules because of the backstop.
And your own contribution to Brexit, the Brexit process so far, the ERG's contribution has been what?
Well, the contribution of the ERG has been to try and maintain the Conservative Party's consistency with its manifesto. That is our aim as a ginger group, to ensure that we do what we said we would do. And as I said earlier, I think politicians ought to do what they said they would do and not try and get out of their commitments.
Okay. Well, I've just had another question come in that should be a rather good final question. From Joachim Sabat, hope I've pronounced your name correctly.
Rather tumultuous, stressful ones for anyone involved in British politics.
I bet Jake has enjoyed them rather.
Surely. How will you be letting your hair down and celebrating, or commiserating as the case may be, on the 29th of March?
That's a very good question. I don't have a lot of long hair to let down. And Boris has had a haircut too, so he doesn't have a lot to let down either anymore. So the problem with the 29th of March is it's in the middle of Lent. So I haven't looked up... The great thing about the Catholic Church is that there is usually dispensation that you can get. And of course, it would be wrong to fast on a feast day. And so I must find out which saint's day it is on the 29th of March. And then let me assure you, if we have really left then, that saint will be so honoured on the 29th of March. Honoured with Paul Roger, honoured with Bollinger, you name it, that saint will be honoured.
Okay, then, well, that's all we've got time for this evening. I'm going to let you go off and let your hairs down in the bars of Soho. Thank you so much for joining us, for making a little piece of history. Tonight we may have a regular weekly show here in the Pleiadian for Jacob, depending on how well the bar takings were in the afternoon. But thanks for coming. Thanks for making this what it was. And please join me in thanking again our guest, Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.